Tom, you, more certainly than any of the other defendants, have been the producer and the coordinator of the defense. First, let me ask what went into your decision and as to whether to present a defense at all.
Well, at the end of the government's case, I think that we had a situation where probably a couple of the jurors felt that the government hadn't presented a case, and from a very narrow legalistic point of view, the government probably had not presented enough evidence of a conspiracy or of our having provoked the so-called disorder. And in a number of areas, like the charges about incendiary devices concerning Lee and John, they had produced almost nothing. And I think that any criminal lawyer in the country would have recommended that we rest, on the grounds that very often in these cases you give more evidence about yourself in making your defense than the government has when it makes its case. And politically, I think that by that time we had succeeded in showing that we were on trial for charges which were ridiculous on the face of it, and that was a mockery. It was a kind of political persecution. And so there were some arguments for quitting at that point. I think that the arguments for going ahead were much stronger, though. And I guess I think that we had a political responsibility to present a defense, to try to show a number of things. First of all, to show that what we feel is the truth about Chicago would be blocked in the courtroom by the collaboration between the judge and the prosecutor, but at least we'd be able to raise questions in the courtroom about Chicago. And secondly, we had a responsibility, I think, to indicate the totally different nature of reality as we understand it, contrasted to what the defense put on. Theirs was a narrow, kind of evil description of revolution, and I thought that we had to put on a more full-blown, colorful, and rich presentation of it, that the people of the country would at least hear something about. I think also by putting on a defense, we were able to help build political support for the case. Only by bringing in defense witnesses, well-known ones as well as lesser-known ones, do you start to get people involved in the trial who then can go out and be speakers, return to their hometowns, return to their political circles, and talk about what they saw and experienced on the witness stand. So by putting on 100, 110 witnesses, we've picked up that many organizers and that many spokesmen around the country. The government has the seven of us, or the eight of us, acting kind of covertly and bringing our nails and Molotov cocktails into Chicago, when in fact the real story of Chicago was that it was the people versus the police. And so we've tried to evoke that through the defense and bring as many of the people in as we possibly could. And the press would cover that, but all of the organs of communication of the movement would cover it, and the people themselves would then be involved in the trial, go out and speak. And I think that that's happened. I think that we've mobilized political support by putting on a defense. I think we've engaged people across the country much more deeply in what the trial is all about. And if the trial is about eliminating what happened in the 1960s, which I think is what Nixon and Mitchell would like to do, the defense, I think, has brought back the 1960s. It's been a kind of historical defense, not a defense at all, but a kind of journey backwards in time to our own political and cultural origins, and then the kind of clarification of those origins for everybody's benefit. I think that the people who read the transcripts and begin to find out what was said in the defense will find that it's one of the most illuminating things that they'll ever be able to read about what's happened in the last 10 years, and it's a good basis for judging what'll happen in the future. And the defense has been the people versus the police state. About 30 out of the 100 witnesses were people who were eyewitnesses to police brutality or were brutalized themselves. And we tried to establish, as I say, a pattern of police brutality directed against almost everyone who was in Chicago, from McCarthy workers to anti-war people to yuppies to newsmen to ministers. We tried to put on 10 or 12 people who were involved in permit negotiations from all angles. The yuppies attempted in early 68 and throughout the summer to get Lincoln Park for their Festival of Life. The mobilization attempted to get permits for sleeping in the parks and meeting in the parks at night, for holding public rallies and demonstrations, and for holding a march to the amphitheater on August 28th. We had some of the negotiators themselves, like Rennie Davis and Mark Simon from mobilization. Abby testified, and Allen Ginsberg testified to some extent about yuppie permit negotiations. And we tried to introduce the fact that the representatives of the Department of Justice, Community Relations Service, were also involved in the negotiations and felt that permits should be given, that Rennie and the yuppies and other groups were reasonable. It was possible to have effective negotiations with us, whereas in the opinion of the Justice Department, Mayor Daley was the rigid and unyielding figure. Takes us into the question of what did happen in Chicago, which we also tried to at least shed some light on in the defense, because it becomes very clear if you establish a deliberate pattern of pervasive police brutality, first of all, and secondly, find that there's a wholly unreasonable posture on the part of the city towards permit negotiations. And you established that there was a division in the United States government from the top levels downward about how to treat demonstrators and how to treat the question of permits. Then you begin to reopen the very deep question and problem of what was happening in the country and what was happening in the government that caused Chicago. Chicago seemed to be a case, from our point of view, of the emergence of a police state, the suspension of normal constitutional rights, and the use of all kinds of techniques of intimidation to reduce the numbers of people coming to demonstrate here. And then the pursuit of even the few who came, pursuit on the part of police against those few who came, forcing a confrontation all over the city. Now that's evident from the testimony, and what that indicates to me, or I think indicates to most of us, is that the time of the convention was a time in which the government was changing its tactics, at least towards young white people, from tactics of tolerance and an attitude of trying to get along with demonstrations, represented by Ramsey Clark, towards an attitude of legalized repression and police terror represented by Lyndon Johnson and Mayor Daley. Now, we can't establish why they did this, but I think that we can establish from our testimony that there was a deliberate decision against the advice of the Attorney General to use tactics of terror and intimidation. And I'm talking particularly about Ramsey Clark's testimony that he was not allowed to give, in which he said that he saw no evidence of the need for prepositioning of federal troops, that that could only create an atmosphere of questioning on the part of people about what those troops were going to be used for. And I think that given the fact that the government, for its case, has now produced a list of witnesses almost exclusively drawn from the FBI, from Army and Navy intelligence, and from the Chicago Police Department, you'd have to say that 1968 saw the emergence into public view of a police state apparatus that was really aimed at trying to return the country to the rule of the 1950s.
Hasn't it been?
That would make sense, of course, since the 1960s began with the retirement of General Eisenhower and they ended with the inauguration of President Nixon. But I do think that all along, throughout the Cold War, we've had an internal police state with a kind of democratic covering, and that in a time of a crisis like the 1960s, the covering tends to fall apart, the police state emerges, and that's what happened in Chicago, and that's what I think this trial demonstrates. Now, beyond that, the major thing that I think we tried to say in our defense had to do with this question of our intent. It's our intent, our state of mind, our consciousness that we've been tried for. And most of the witnesses who testified about that intent in coming to Chicago and demonstrated in court the kind of identity that we want to project. Well, we have been trying to use all options available to us. I should have said that, I think, earlier. We've been trying to deny the charges that are specifically lodged against us. That is, that we had the intention of inciting a riot. We deny that. We say that that there was a deliberate plan of repression rather than our having incited a riot. It was a planned police brutality and a planned official attitude towards demonstrators that occurred. And we think that that can be presented honestly to a jury. I think a jury can understand that. And we've attempted to do that, but we've also attempted to show the jury and show everybody that we feel we're not being tried for Chicago in the narrow sense that the government presents it. We're being tried, as Ramsey Clark says, as a signal for the beginning of political repression. They're not after us for Chicago, but they're after us because of all that we represent. And the decision was made by Attorney General Mitchell that this was kind of a example that he was going to use to scare people all over the country and to get rid of some people, or at least tie some people up for some time. So we've tried to present a specific rebuttal to what we're charged with, and also generally point out what I think is now evident to the jury, that it's not really what we're being tried for. What we're really being tried for is everything that we did and millions of other people did in the 1960s. I think that you'll never convince the ultra-respectable people of how to put on a political trial, however. I mean, they would argue that we should have put on no defense, and then if we're going to put on a defense, they would argue to put on nothing but little old ladies and innocent bystanders. And that would be, I think, a betrayal of our own politics, to go to that extreme of trying to play the legal game. On the other hand, we're not into taking credit for what we didn't do, and we're not into a kind of adventurous and total disruption of the courtroom at all. We're trying to play kind of a balancing strategy out to the finish. The same people, the ultra-respectable people, I think also have a different view of the system than we do. They have a faith in the system. For instance, they feel that the law will be held to be unconstitutional. And they seem to have more faith in the system than they do in the jury. And certainly more faith in the system than they do in the people. More faith in the upper courts than they have in the masses of people. A political strategy for the trial, though, that we would have, rests on having no faith in the system, rests on the idea that if we're to get appeal bond or get the case reversed at the upper levels, it'll require a political mobilization of a very powerful kind, because otherwise the stacking of the Supreme Court and the policy of repression will keep us in jail for years. And we have a faith in the jury and a faith in the people, while having almost no faith in the system. Faith in the jury means something like what it meant to have faith in the American people at the beginning of the anti-war movement. That is, here are these 12 jurors and two alternates drawn out of so-called Middle America, with little or nothing in common with us as far as we know, chosen from voter lists, with a class background that would indicate that they should be conservative, they should be protective of the social order. And they're made jurors in a kind of a 1984 situation. They're sequestered, they're taken here and there by federal marshals. They are told endless lies by the government about us. We're not allowed to speak to them. We're not allowed to have any direct communication with them except through the terrible filtering process of the courtroom. And it's hard to believe, if you're as alienated from the system as we are, that such people could be brought around. And it's an open question whether people of this kind can be brought around. There has been an awakening on the Vietnam War, however. And not a sufficient awakening, but a certain awakening. And it's conceivable to me that in a prolonged political struggle inside the courtroom, we could help to awaken consciousness and the conscience of some of those jurors, and we could create, through our being there day after day in a prolonged, extended political struggle, we could create solidarity between some of them and some of us. Whereas I think the ultra-respectables in the courtroom and in the press take one look at the jury and write it off because the jury looks like a bunch of Agnew people or Wallace people who are to be feared. Now, by saying that, I am hardly saying that I believe in the jury trial system. I'm saying that I have at least a small confidence that if you do it in the in a prolonged way, you might be able to find, even in a rigged system like the jury system, some people who will come onto your side. Just as in a rigged political system, some people have awakened to what's going on in Vietnam. But I think beyond that, there's the masses of people.
Be and this specific.
Let me just say, just on this, the masses of people are the ultimate jury.
Bill, what do you predict will be the outcome of the trial in terms of the verdict from the jury? What do you expect the charges to the judge, from the judge to the jury will be? And in general, what's your opinion as to the outcome?
Well, I really don't care so much what the outcome is in one sense, because I think the defendants have won the case already. I think as far as the country is concerned, the verdict, most thinking people, is that the defendants have exposed what both the court system is and a system of government that thrives on repression and oppression. The judge's charges will be very harsh ones. When I say harsh, I mean those which are oriented toward a conviction. And I think that they will discourage the defendants no end when they hear them in court in the way he reads anything which he intends to hurt people, with a certain histrionic emphasis which we complained of when he read the indictment to the jury. I think that there is a strong possibility of a hung jury. We have a lot of hard stuff in the record which a lot of jurors will have a tough time swallowing. But I think the defense has been honest. We've presented every shade of opinion, from revolutionaries to pacifists, from black militants to essentially Uncle Toms. We've given a whole gamut of experience and range of life and lifestyle. And I think that in the light of this, there is a possibility, a strong one, that some jurors will find that we've been honest and candid, we've exposed the good and the bad, but there has been no conspiracy to incite riot proved.
So you think, in other words, that this case is in many ways like the convention of last year, where the demonstrators in the streets won the hearts of the people, so to speak, and you think that this might very well be the case actually when this trial is over, regardless of whether the verdict is one of guilty or not guilty, nonetheless, the truth has been told. Do you think it's been told as effectively as it could have been told in the courtroom?
Well, I think it's been told as effectively as it could have been. I think that other planners in planning such a defense could have had other variations and so on. But I'm satisfied internally, in my own conscience, that the job done by the defendants has been an excellent one. I think they have won the situation. I think that your definition or your comparison to the convention is very good. Whatever happens in the courtroom, I think, is kind of irrelevant. What has happened is the defendants, I think, have won the hearts of the country, and I don't mean the great silent majority, but among thinking people and articulate people in the country by what they've done in the courtroom. And I think that that's where the real verdict lies. And I think that's where politically most of these defendants would rather have the verdict from, not from a jury selected in an antiquated and unfair system, but from a jury of their peers, those who really share the same sensations and the same vibrations that they do.
What kind of people do you think are on the jury, Bill?
Well, I've looked at the jury, as you have, for God knows how long now, and I think the jury is probably a cross-section of a certain portion of America. It's a cross-section of the middle class and a certain type of the middle class, what I would call the lower middle class, in essence. It's probably a cross-section of the silent majority, with a few possible exceptions on the jury. And they're not real exceptions, but they are people who are willing to listen. And I think there are two or three of those on that jury. Otherwise, it's much less like the country at large. It's Nixon's jury, in essence, the same jury that passes on the war in Vietnam and finds it not oppressive enough to demand that it be discontinued immediately. But who have a vague feeling that America is the land of promises and the land of equality and justice, and who are, I guess, in a certain sense, what you call patriotic people. They're very dangerous people to a group of defendants who present lifestyles so absolutely different from their own.
Do you think that your hunch that there may be one or two people on that jury who might hang it are... That they in fact are exceptions to that kind of of description that you just gave to the gave to describing the jury? Do you think that perhaps there are a few people who've been confronted by some of the things that have gone on in that courtroom, and perhaps it might have been the first time that they may have been confronted by different lifestyles, or they've been forced to look at them at least, and that might have some bearing on their decision?
I don't think, Mickey, they're exceptions. I think that there are a few people on there that have certain sensibilities which are a little more defined than their neighbors in the jury box, and that these people can be educated, and I think they have been educated throughout this trial.
it's our hope only that the education continues through deliberation and that they stick to their guns if they are confronted with 8 or 9 or 10 adamant jurors who say we want to convict and we must convict. These are no good people who must be put away for the benefit of society. If they stick and they hold out, then we will have that hung jury. If not, they'll kind of relapse back into the general pot from which they sprang and go back into the silent majority, having, I think, shirked probably the finest responsibility of their life.
You've had a number of opportunities to represent some of the more notable so-called celebrities in the movement, from Martin Luther King to Rap Brown, and I don't mean that in any kind of polarized way at all. What kind of role have you seen yourself as a lawyer playing in this case, and has it been any different from the kind of role that you played in other cases that you've had occasion to participate in?
That's a very hard question to answer, Mickey, but I would say this. I've been representing this type of client for just 10 years. The fifth decade of my life has been spent in this type of work. And in the beginning, I started out with, I think, a very racist, very chauvinistic view of myself, that I would make the decisions, the lawyer was the king, and the lawyer would just have clients, because you need clients to be a lawyer, but you don't need them for any other purpose except to have names on a complaint or names in an indictment to give you a forum for yourself. I finally come around, and it's hard for me because I have a very strong ego. I finally come around to where I now see myself as someone who is only employed to help other people find a vehicle for their own convictions and their own political theories and desires. And I think that's where I am in this case. In no other case, even with Dr. King, who did not have strong feelings about what went on in the courtroom and who would not dictate what you were to do whatsoever, I think that I now am in a position where I've relegated the importance of my role to where I think it properly belongs, to be a functionary and servant of the people who are the thought provokers, who are the leaders, who are the people who have the respect of hundreds of thousands and millions of people in their particular fields, like a Dellinger, like a Bobby Seale, and so on. And I think that with these people, I now have reached what I think is a true role for myself, and that is serving them and expounding for them, or working out whatever means I have to do so, a vehicle or a forum for the expressions of their own political views.
A couple of times during the course of the trial, Bill, in line with your response to the last question, you've been called some pretty nasty things by the prosecution. I think at one point during the moratorium commemorances, you were called a mouthpiece. Did you take that as a compliment, or did that kind of get under your skin a little bit?
I didn't take it as a compliment. I took it as a very derogatory remark, because the word mouthpiece used to mean a lawyer for a criminal syndicate. He was called a mob's mouthpiece, and it had a very derogatory aspect to it in that he was supposed to be mouthing, the vocal spokesman for an unsavory group who used a conventional means of expression for their own nefarious purposes. On the other hand, I take the word mouthpiece, as maybe Mr. Ferran meant it, to have another meaning. And in that, I don't think it's so derogatory, because maybe I am a spokesman in some ways of the views of the clients I represent. And maybe that's a proper function for a lawyer to be, within the limits of what he can do in a courtroom, to provide the forum that I mentioned before of expounding certain social and political and economic views of his client. If that was the intent of Mr. Friend, then I accept it kindly and gladly. I think he probably meant the other thing, that I was just a parrot for anything Tom Hayden or Jerry Rubin said. I think that the defendants know that isn't so, but the lawyers have been very, very receptive to the thoughts of the clients, and it is the clients who are running the case, not the lawyers. I think the old canon of ethics that said the lawyers must really run the case and be responsible for everything in the courtroom, it doesn't fit a political trial. The clients must have the responsibility and the energy and the authority to really run their own case. After all, it's their necks that are on the chopping block, and I think they have a right to try to save them, if they can, by the methods they want to use, or even if they don't want to save them, if they're going to have their heads chopped off, to go down the way they want to go down.
When you indicated that you worked very closely with the defendants, this wasn't just sort of a a structured kind of thing wherein people say that they work very closely. You actually did, they actually do, in fact, run their case, don't they?
Yeah, there's no question about that. It's really quite a working democracy, because, as you know, we voted on many things as a voting unit of 9 or 10 or 11 people, and the votes were whether to accept the jury, as it was, if you recall, way back in September. And we have, with rare exceptions, there have been breakdowns in this, but with rare exceptions, we have voted, we have had a certain type of method of reaching a decision on almost every important crisis in the trial. And sometimes that fails, sometimes we don't communicate, sometimes there are frayed nerves. But in general, I think, from my experience, it's been a very harmonious relationship.